It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks everyone for showing up at this untimely hour in the morning. And thanks Kurt and Mark and Paul for inviting me to this program. I'm enjoying it very much, and I'm sure I'll enjoy it until the bittersweet end of it. What I'm going to talk about today is a little bit more applied than some of the things we've seen yesterday. I'm actually trying to use coarse graining techniques to develop models for membranes and proteins in such a way that in some chemically realistic sense, I can try to make predictions for experimentalists that we try to work with. So this is work I've done together with very talented postdoc Xinjing Wang and a very talented graduate student, Tristan Barrault, at Carnegie Mellon. So let me briefly give you an outline of what it is that I'm trying to talk about. So if you open a book on molecular cell biology, you see that the kind of beast that you like to deal with is an object such as this. Very complicated, very complex, very organic, convoluted. And almost everything you see in this picture is on membranes. So membranes are, in that sense, the crucial structural element of a cell, keeps things together. It's the outer cell membrane, but also many organelles inside cells are membrane-derived, such as the cell nucleus, the endoplasmic reticulum, the Golgi, the mitochondria. They all have fancy names. So it's the membranes that derive, that give a cell all its structure. But in some sense, it's the proteins in the cells that do all the work, either by just being floating around, being catalysts, or being bound to membranes. And because they're bound to membranes, they do interesting biochemistry, or because they give membranes the very shape they have. So in some sense, it's the interaction between membranes and proteins that gives all the fun in membrane biophysics. So I'd like to understand these things. Now, a lot of times, these things happen on processes that are at large lengths and time scales, such as if you look at these tubulations of membranes and the shape changes of the Golgi. Those are big length scales. We're not talking about the action of a single protein channel and how a potassium ion goes through this or doesn't go through it. We're talking about big things, and we like to understand these things. So how would we do that? On top of that, very often when proteins do things to membranes, the structure of these proteins is either not known. That's the big problem of it's much harder to crystallize membrane proteins, or it changes in the process. So you might have to change the structure of the protein that limits you to the kind of protein models that you can use because some of them fix the structure and that's a problem. So within this framework of boundary conditions on the physics, the question to a physicist is, are there any generic principles at work that I might be able to learn something about? And because as a physicist I'm asking generic principle, I take the liberty of saying, well, if there are any generic principles, I might actually be able to discover them using very simple models. Because anything that can be seen, even on the level of a simple model, is probably generic. So in that framework, what we would like to do is we like to use tools of the following ilk. We like to use chemically realistic but coarse-grained models of both membranes and of proteins. And I'd like to warn you right ahead of time, when I say chemically realistic, I do not mean chemically accurate. What I mean is that I'm capable of representing aspects of the chemistry that I think are important, but not necessarily at chemical accuracy. Just please don't confuse these two notions. I would like to do it in such a way that I don't necessarily have to bias secondary structure in my protein model, precisely for the reason that it might be that this structure changes. So I would like to keep these things open and not bias things to one structure and be done with it. In some sense, I would like to have a modicum of transferability. Kind of everyone wants that. How much you can have in terms of transferability is a little bit up in the air. It's, I think, so far still a not very well understood protein under which, not well understood problem under which conditions you do get transferability. My belief is that if you manage to capture the right bits of physics, you have a better chance of getting transferability than if you just, I don't know, heavily parameterize things. And at the end of the day, because I'm looking at big structures, I would like to do all of this without having to bother with the solvent. So we're talking implicit solvent models throughout. So what I would like to talk about in my presentation is that we think a certain fraction of this tall order we have actually accomplished. So the menu for today is that I tell you a little bit about the membrane model we have developed, a little bit about the peptide model we have developed, and how we have cross-parameterized it. Now my problem is I really would like to talk about the cross-parameterization, but first I need to talk about the two bits that I will cross-parameterize, so I'll have to spend a lot of time doing this. I hope I manage to do this within the allotted time. If not, just cut me off. And then at the end, very briefly, I give you just two examples of the kind of things I think you can do with these kinds of models. So let me talk about the membrane model first developed recently by my postdoc Xinjing Wang. So the idea is we take a model of a membrane that is like medium resolution coarse grained. You have these, I mean, these little beads are what's actually a chemically accurate representation of a lipid, and the big beads is what chemists would look at and give particular names. They would say, this big thing up there, I recognize this, I would call this a choline group. Or we call this a phosphate, a glycerol, an ester, and yada yada. And because chemists think that these entities are important enough to deserve a name, maybe there's a reason, and maybe we should then go ahead and create a coarse grain bead that will be a choline bead or a phosphate bead, and so on. So this is the way we do the mapping. In fact, this particular lipid would have a palmitoyl chain, an oleoyl chain, a phosphate, and a choline. So this thing would go under the name POPC, which stands for this name. And in that sense, I'm trying to be chemically realistic, so that I say I'm not just simulating some generic lipid, I'm simulating something that experimenters would recognize as POPC. And when I just later change to DOPC, I'll see changes in the things I observe that are expected in terms of, I mean, the experimentalists would say, yes, that's indeed what should happen. This level of resolution, of course, we're not the first to do that. There's a variety of lipids out there. In fact, more than 10 years ago, in the group of Mike Klein, there was a very nice model, parameterized in a very similar spirit to what I'm going to show to you, even though they had done it with solvent back then. And yesterday, Sasha Ljubarts have showed us a model that he developed in a similar spirit. So, how are we going to do that? Well, the idea that we had is we're going to use structure-based coarse grating for basically most of the non-bonded interactions, but that's not all we're going to do. We need extra information such as density and pressure profiles from experiment and from simulation to constrain our parameters. And in fact, we need experimental values such as the area per lipid, because even existing atomistic force fields are not necessarily good enough to reproduce these things. We need to fix certain aspects that atomistic models get wrong to make sure we don't make big mistakes in this one. I'm going to show you what that means. So here's an example. The red curve is an electron density profile across a bilayer, so left side of the bilayer, center, right side of the bilayer. And the dotted points are an atomistic simulation of a system, sort of a simulation we would use as a target for our coarse graining. And that's a very, very good fit. But the remarkable thing is that even this model, if you do an atomistic simulation at the correct area per lipid, you get basically the correct structure. But if you now ask what are the stresses in my membrane, and now I relax the stresses and do everything under zero applied tension, the membrane would shrink by about 15%. So in some sense, the equation of state, even in the atomistic simulation for this thing, is fairly wrong. Partially because we used a sort of somewhat outdated version of a charm force field. But either way, I mean, just because you get the structure right and convince yourself that you do, even in atomistic simulation, you can't be sure that other things, such as the equation of state, works out well. So, and we've heard that theme a few times already in that conference. So that means there's something that we might have to fix even if we have atomistic truth to begin with. And I'll show you how we do that. So the strategy is going to be that we use the simulations at the correct area per lipid to infer as much structure as we think we can put into the model. And we introduce additional cohesion in our coarse grain model to drive aggregation of the lipids in the absence of water. Remember that if I throw the water away, I have to do something about the now absence of the hydrophobic effect. But we can use the way we do this in order to fix the problem with the area per lipid, because the amount of adhesion we're going to put in will determine the equilibrium area per lipid. So there's, unfortunately, the knob that I could tune. The way we do this is that we say, here are, let's say, two lipids. We're going to create some phenomenological cohesion between these lipids driven by potentials of this kind, and we can tune the strength of these potentials and how strong they are at various depths in the bilayer. We can choose these in order to optimize the area per lipid and the pressure profile as far as we know that they should look like. So here's an example of what you then get. This is a pair correlation function between an aliphatic side chain bead, an aliphatic bead in the tail. So the red thing is the all atom, the blue thing is the coarse grain. Of course, they all fit because that's sort of what we want them to do. This was done using iterative Boltzmann techniques, again, a technique we have talked about many times already in this conference. And we did this basically for every existing pair interaction that we have, every non-bonded pair interaction in our system. So here's a bunch of other examples. So this is what I just showed you. This is not quite as good. This is not quite as good. This is our worst case example of how we fit things. You might say, well, this, I mean, yes, you do get the peak positions, but why doesn't it exactly fit? I mean, you parameterize on structure. Why doesn't it work exactly? The answer is I'm not quite sure I understand why, but I would like to point out that it's not clear whether this discrepancy is just poor convergence, or whether actually I can get it quite right. Because, I mean, neither the existence nor the uniqueness of these pair potentials under these complicated conditions where I just don't have non-bonded interactions, but extra bonded interactions and lots of other things on top. It's not clear to me that things such as Henderson's theorem would apply in this situation, telling me you will have to have a unique solution. So we might not, and we might not fully get it, but I think this is about as good as we can get, and it'll give rise to very good properties of the membranes. So let me show you what you get with this membrane model. So the first thing you really want to test is that this thing self-assembles. So we start with a random solution of lipids, and we really go for a while. We use parallel tempering techniques to convince ourselves that this thing actually does go into a bilayer. So we can convince ourselves that whatever force field we have come up with, the bilayer is in fact the thermodynamically stable phase. Even though we have parameterized it from the bilayer, that doesn't mean it would be it's expected, but you should test that. In fact, one referee pointed out, well, how do you not know you haven't totally overstabilized the bilayer phase now? So we did other tests to convince ourselves that we haven't done that. So we can now look at other things that we haven't put into the model, such as bond order parameters along the tails. For instance, every one of these points is a particular value for the bond order parameter. This is the saturated tail. This is the unsaturated tail. Very nicely, you see that at the point where the double bond happens, the bond order drops by about 0.2, and this is expected, and this is nice. These are a little bit outside of the error bars, but all the trends come out right. So we have correct, again, chemically specific aspects. I remind you, this is just a single, in some sense, a single bond interaction at this point that gives rise to a substantial change in the order here. And later on, if you look at the phase diagrams, it's going to shift the phase transition by 30 degrees. This one interaction here, quite remarkable. So what else? The other thing that, of course, you always want to know when you have a bilayer is, okay, what's its bending rigidity? The way we've determined it is we looked at the fluctuation spectrum of a massive membrane from fluctuations using the usual formula that the bending modulus is KT, basically over the mode spectrum. We get something between 8 and 10 times 10 to the minus 20 joules. The experimental value is somewhere in the middle of that, as we're pretty confident we got that right. That's quite impressive. Phase behavior, our bilayer shows a liquid gel transition, so this is the temperature at which we parameterize it. If we cool this by 30 degrees, it does go into the gel phase. You could do this as a function of temperature. By the way, we have entered the questions of transferability. If I move the temperature, what would happen? Indeed, the area per lipid shrinks, and at some point, it goes sort of onto a different branch where the compressibility is very different. If you cycle back and forth between these things, you see fairly substantial hysteresis, which shows you it's a difficult transition to sample. We didn't really try to pinpoint it very well, but I can tell you that that's the point where we parameterize it, and that's the point where very long atomistic simulations claim the phase transition happens for POPC, with the liquid gel phase transition. Okay. One more thing, diffusion. So what would you do with diffusion? You measure the root mean square displacement, and at long times that should be linear. So from a straight line fit, you get a diffusion constant of something, micron squared per tau. Say, what on earth is tau? In order to get tau, we do a mapping to the usual diffusion constant of a real system, and then you say, okay, it shouldn't be that big. It should really be this big. So you say, well, maybe I have the usual speed up factor problem. And that's sort of how we map timescale. And I would like to make sure that I make myself very clear here. I do expect a speed-up factor in this situation, and this is sort of how we determine it, but this in some sense really is poor man's dynamics, because there's no reason to expect that every other timescale of the problem, such as the relaxation of the bond order or flipping of lipids and all of this, is happening with the same speed-up factor. The only reason really I'm doing this is because invariably when I do a simulation with this, there's going to be some question that says, okay, how long was that simulation? And I say, so it's not many time steps. What's that in seconds? And I'm like, it's a really, really hard question if you're doing a coarse grain simulation, but that's sort of my first way out. Roughly, that's what it corresponds to. Okay. One more example for transferability. If we take one of these tails and chop it off and replace it by the other tail, I'm creating a different lipid. So if I chop the unsaturated tail off and replace it by the saturated one, I create a lipid called DPPC, and if I do the other thing, I create a lipid called DLPC. And without any reparameterization, I couldn't know what are the properties of these new lipids. So in particular, I could look at things such as what's the area per lipid. And the area per lipid is then fairly easy to measure. You just do a long simulation. You see it's very well equilibrated. You see that for DOPC, the area per lipid is bigger. For DPPC, the area per lipid is smaller. In fact, we have to do DPPC at a slightly higher temperature because it's 310 Kelvin. It's a gel phase already. And you can get the numbers and all of this and figure out you're within a couple of percents. The error is biggest for DOPC for reasons we think we understand. It has something to do with the implicit solvent problem. But this is encouraging. It's another indication that the way we've done it, we probably have more transferability than we should honestly expect. That's the lipid model we're going to use. All right, so what's the peptide model we're going to use? So this is a model that's been developed by my student Tristan Barrault. And the philosophy of this model is the following thing. In some sense, it's an inverse martini. If you know the martini model, it's a little bit poor on the backbone, but very careful on the side chains. We're doing the opposite. We're being fairly careful on the backbone and fairly cheap on the side chains. The reason is, as I told you, I'm interested in proteins for which I can't always be sure I know ahead of time what the structure is. The structure might change, secondary structure changes might happen. I want the protein model itself to find structure. I'm not saying I want my protein model to fold. That's a tall order for a coarse grain system. Not even atomistic force fields are capable of reliably folding things in all situations. But I want some sort of secondary structure capture. So that's why we do a model where we have four beads per amino acid, three of which are on the backbone, namely the central carbon, the amide group, and the carbonyl group. And we have one bead for the side chain. This is the point where we are cheap. Of course, there would be an oxygen and hydrogen there as well. We implicitly model them, but the presence of these things, well, the implicit presence of these things will give rise to the hydrogen bond. That's extremely important. Models of this kind, again, have been proposed before. This is along the same spirit that what these people have done. So what goes into these models? The usual thing, harmonic bonds, harmonic angles, dihedrals, and so on. In particular, the dihedral at the C-alpha is very important to fix the chirality because peptides are chiral with the exception of glycine. Extruded volume interactions are very important, and turn out a very large amount of this is essentially fixed by the Ramachandran plot, as I will show. And we have more complicated things, such as what are the hydrophobic interactions, particularly on the side chains? How do we do hydrogen bonds? The fact that the peptide bond has a dipole, what do we do with these things? And the last three things turn out, you can tune them very well because they're very, very strong constraints from just observing folding characteristics of medium size as simple peptides. So how does that work? First of all, the Ramachandran plot. If you look at the usual thing, a tripeptide, then the middle bit is one-to-one peptide. It has along its backbone three angles, phi, psi, and omega. The omega is not really a very interesting angle because it's essentially fixed because the peptide bond is sort of basically a double bond. But these two move and they give the backbone its flexibility and its major degrees of freedom. So what you're looking at, what's then the interesting thing to look at is the joint probability density of these two angles, or turned into free energy if you like, that would be called a Ramachandran plot. If this would be glycine, 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 it looks roughly like this. If this is glycine, alanine, glycine, or glycine, anything not glycine, glycine, it looks like this. It's asymmetric because it's chiral, and it has certain regions that are very well populated and other regions which are forbidden, essentially for excluded volume reasons. These things can't overlap in certain ways. And then you basically, one thing that you want to do is you want to get the characteristics of that plot right. So it has certain regions, for instance, the region here corresponds to beta conformations of the backbone, the region here corresponds to alpha regions. Those are among the most important secondary structure elements, so you A, want them to be present, and B, the relative depth of these minima, you want them to be fairly okay. So that's something that strongly constrains the extruded volume interactions. Extremely important, of course, is the hydrogen bond. So if you have, let's say, the carbonyl and the amide group, there's a hydrogen bond between these things which clicks all kinds of structures, alpha, beta, and so on together. It's basically obvious how you would do that. You have a potential that's strongly distance dependent and has a very preferred distance where it clicks. On top of that, it has a strong angular dependence, which means both these angles basically have to point in the right direction, and that's the only situation when it clicks. So these kinds of potentials were proposed before. We're just using these things here. And the range is adjusted according to what we know of hydrogen bonds. The strength, however, we don't know, and that we adjust, again, by folding properties of medium-sized peptides, as I'll show in a second. Here's the issue with the peptide bond dipole. So here's a single amino acid, and here's a peptide bond from the carbonyl to the amide. And if you look, for instance, at the conformation of an alpha helix, you see that you have these dipoles in a row, and they point in the same direction. If, on the other hand, you have a bit of a beta sheet, then it turns out these peptide dipoles point in opposite direction. So as far as electrostatics is concerned, there's a certain difference between these situations. Now, in our coarse-grained model, we don't model partial charges, so this effect would be entirely gone. But it's important because it very clearly affects the balance between alpha and beta. But since these things happen at the level of the Ramachandran angles, what you can do is you can sort of bias your phi psi dihedrals in your model to make sure you shift the balance between beta and alpha back to the value where it should be. So this is what we do. And the final, like most thought intense part of modeling is, well, if you have eugenic side chains, how would they interact? Clearly, the most important thing you need to capture is the wide difference in hydrophobicity of these side chains. And the way you would do this in an implicit solvent model is, of course, you'd say, well, if they're hydrophobic, they attract somehow, and if they're hydrophilic, they don't. Well, that's sort of obvious, but the question is, how strong would you make that attraction? So we have decided to do it in the following way. We start with the so-called Mia-Sava-Jernigan matrix, which is sort of knowledge-based potentials that say, well, if you look at the matrix of all the amino acids, and I look at the protein data bank and see how likely is it that certain amino acids are going to be close to each other, that will be some sort of a measure for how much they like each other, therefore how hydrophobic they are, because hydrophobic things are more likely going to be together than hydrophilic things. It's not quite as easy as that because the whole structure of the protein matters in this context, and it's not just hydrophobicity that is parameterized in this thing. But we decided to try this as an input parameter in the following way. First, we try to approximately factorize the Mia-Sava-Jernigan matrix into sort of a diet of only 20 parameters. If you do that, you still realize that the correlation between these numbers and these numbers is on the order of 98%. That just means that we don't lose a lot by factorization. Next thing is we sort of normalize the values of these epsilon between 0 and 1. And then it turns out that the correlation between these normalized values and something that you could somewhere else look up as a hydrophobicity scale is something like 87%. So it means, first of all, we sort of seem to be capturing the right thing. We could have started with a hydrophobicity scale to begin with. But somehow the fact that this is not 100% means, A, well, either we're screwing something up in the process, or Mia-Sava-Jernigan matrix indeed accounts for more than just hydrophobicity. Either way, so if we do this, then with these rescaled epsilons, we have an implicit, sort of a relative scale of how hydrophobic amino acids are with respect to each other. And what I then need is a single one more parameter overall that multiplies this that tells me the interaction strength. And this one I'll have to tune. So at the end of the day, we have a fairly small number of tunable parameters, and we try to fix those. So let me show what I mean by we'd like to get folding characteristics right. So this is a simulation of 73 amino acid protein that's called a three-helix bundle, which, well, it's called that because it goes into a three-helix bundle at the end of the day. And this is a simulation after parameter tuning. And it does the right thing. It turns into such a bundle, and this takes about 10 hours. Now, it's very non-trivial that it does that. And the reason is, all hydrophobicity, hydrogen bonds, and dipole terms have to come out right, otherwise it wouldn't work. If you have mistuned the hydrophobicity, you need hydrophobicity to get proper helix alignment because the inside of these helixes is a bit more hydrophobic, that's why it turns that way. But if you make the hydrophobicity too strong, the whole thing will just collapse into one hydrophobic globule. So you can't do this too high. If you do this too low, it will not orient well. The hydrogen bonds are important because those give rise to secondary structure formation, but if you tune it just a little bit too high, the whole thing will just make one big helix, which clearly also is wrong. And finally, the dipole term is important because you do want these alpha helices, but you also want beta sheets. And it turns out it's very hard to get beta sheets in these models. So you need to tune the hydrogen bond term in such a way to make beta more likely, but not so much that this thing doesn't happen anymore. Basically, it turned out that we needed to go up to the very edge of what we can do with this term in order to get the right balance. Okay, one example of the few things we've done with this thing is a microcanonical folding analysis of this three helix bundle. So here's the energy of our system, and this is in some sense an entropy minus a linear term. and you see a very nice double well structure in this, which tells you this is basically a two-state folder. There's a latent heat involved for this finite system. There's a barrier involved, and we can look at a whole bunch of aspects for why does it fold? How is secondary structure being created at the expense of tertiary structure that's being molten in a way from here to there? Everything comes out strongly aligned with what people previously learned about the system, so we think we got that right. So I'm running out of time. So let me now see how you do the cross-parameterization after you know what my two toy models are. The aim in this cross-parameterization, if I want to make the proteins talk to my membrane, the aim is that I want to reproduce the free energy of insertion of a single amino acid into a bilayer. And how do I know what that value is? Because thankfully other people have done that before. On the level of atomistic simulation, the target data for this come from the group of Peter Thielemann, who've taken basically all the amino acids, minus two or something, and dragged them into the bilayer. So the idea is this. Okay, let me just show you what that means. So here's our lipid. This is what the peptide, a single amino acid looks like, but actually to the same scale, it looks like this. So you realize that once you want to make these things talk to each other, it's probably okay to replace an entire amino acid by a single bead as far as the crosstalk is concerned. Okay, so a single amino acid will just be a single bead once it's in the bilayer, and I need to parameterize the interaction of this one bead with any one of these beads in the bilayer to reproduce curves such as this. These are free energy of insertion profiles. The red curves are coarse grain simulations. The blue are the atomistic ones. So this is basically said, okay, out here in the bulk, so this is bulk, this is bilayer center. For alanine, for instance, the free energy is zero, then it goes up because alanine is a hydrophobic amino acid and doesn't like to be in the head group region of the bilayer, but then it drops because it likes to be inside the bilayer. And essentially these four possibilities is what all these functions look like, and you need to tune the interactions to get them. Turns out all the generic features can essentially reasonably easily be captured. Sharp features, that is such as steep drops, are hard to get because you have a lower resolution model. Anything that's sharp and fine is very hard to get. So we don't try to overparameterize. We could make some of these things better, but then my student tells me in order to get it better, I have to tune certain interactions to such an unphysically realistic value. I don't want to do this. This is an example of how you occasionally don't want to overparameterize your model, because otherwise sort of other physics is likely going to go out of the window. The final interaction potentials are likely not unique. You shouldn't expect that because, I mean, why would you even want any uniqueness at this point? This is not a problem. Also, since there's a certain error anyways in the target data, I don't try to match every single aspect of these things. So here's an example of one thing that you get in that context. So let's look at this for instance. This is glutamate in the bilayer, which is a charged amino acid, and you can do a simple continuum calculation and expect the energy should be 100 kT. Well, it's not 100 kT. It's something like, I don't know, between 25 and 35 kT. Why is it not 100? And the reason it's not 100 is because the bilayer, once you put a charged amino acid, in this case arginine, into the bilayer, there's a very hefty deformation of the bilayer that goes along. The bilayer prefers to strongly locally destroy its bilayer structure because that's cheaper than burying a charged amino acid in the middle of a bilayer. And this deformation, in some sense, this is the atomistic equivalent of this, is interesting, is fairly well captured in the model despite the fact that we don't have any electrostatics in here. But the free energy of insertion is fairly high, and as a consequence, the bilayer responds. So you might now look at, do I get certain things right? Does this work well? So one thing you could do is you can take a helix, this is a Wolp peptide, put it in a bilayer and look at all kinds of things. The one thing I'm going to show you are the tilt fluctuations of the angle. You might say, well, this is how hard can that be? Basically, you need to take the length of this thing and that will predict the angle. In the sense that if you make it longer, you go from warp 23 to warp 27, the angle shifts up a little bit, probably like the cosine of this angle times the length is the thickness or something like this. Turns out that's actually not true. It looks as if this is true, but the physics behind this thing is entirely different. And it's entirely obscured by plots such as this, which seem to indicate that there's a preferred angle. But if you plot the probability as a function of angle, you miss the fact that there's a Jacobian. That there's a Jacobian in the problem which says that angle zero is extremely unlikely because it has measure zero in your probability. So you should really divide out that Jacobian before you talk about things such as free energies. And one way of doing this is plotting this not as a function of angle, but as a function of cosine of the angle, and then you realize, and then you take the log and you have a free energy, then you realize that the most likely state seems to be just everything nicely sitting in the bilayer, and then the energy goes up. And the reason why you get bigger angles for longer peptides is because there's a wider range of angles which it samples. Okay? And this comes out nicely in the model. Okay? Two quick applications. The first one is we looked again at a warp peptide, but we didn't fold it, we had it fold by the system. So this is a tremendous effort to do. We did a replica exchange simulation, something that amounts to about 8 microseconds approximately. And we could fold it at 356 Kelvin. We couldn't do it at room temperature, and the reason is that it's still extremely strongly constrained to fold inside a bilayer environment. We're pretty lucky that we can do it at these temperatures without any other constraints, such as stabilizing the bilayer or stuff like this. So that was one thing. The other thing I'd like to show you is a pore formation by antimicrobial peptides. So we put things, in this case meganins, on the membrane. We initially pre-folded them as helices because that's what people believe they are. We put them on the bilayer, and after a while they aggregate, they reform, and they create a pore in the bilayer. They do not stay helices. Some of these helices break, and interestingly enough, the first time the helix forms, not a single one of these antimicrobial peptides is actually penetrating through. Even though when people talk about pores and bilayers due to antimicrobial peptides, you always have these things sitting around there. I should be very careful. I don't want to make this too big of a story, because you would have to look at all kinds of other test details here to extract the physics. I'm showing this in order to illustrate the kinds of problems that you could treat with these models. You can capture refolding of the peptide, you can get the long scales to look at pores, and so on. So this is, and using models such as this, we think there's a whole set of other problems we could treat in that way. So thank you very much for attention. These were the people who did the work. I gave the talk. This is where some of the money came from, and I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Questions, comments? Sure.
Marcus, I have an embarrassing question about the double well picture of protein simulation, where you have energy on horizontal axis and you simulated microcanonical ensemble.
Yeah.
And you said it's entropy on the vertical axis.
Yeah.
And I vaguely remember from my teaching of statistical mechanics that the derivative is inverted temperature and should be positive.
Yeah, that's a simple answer. This is probably minus the entropy. What I'm doing, you know, the entropy basically.
No, that would not help me, because it changes signs every time.
No, hang on. The entropy basically should be concave. The reason why these two wells are at the same height, because there's a linear trend we're subtracting. Now, why is there this convexity in there? And the reason is, well, it's a finite system. There's no reason why the entropy should be concave for a finite system. In fact, it's not in this case.
But then temperature is negative.
No, temperature as defined by the derivative of the n, so one over t is ds by dE would then be negative, yes. There's no problem in this in the microcanonical ensemble. If you look at an Ising model, a Potts model, or anything like this, you look at the entropy as a function of energy, there's no reason why the entropy should be a concave function. It's not. When it's in the thermodynamic limit, it will be. For finite systems, it's not. And the temperature as defined, 1 over T is dS by dE, does not coincide with the temperature, let's say, coming from the fluctuation of the heat capacity, which would be canonical temperature. These are different, and only in the thermodynamic limit do they coincide.
Okay, I think we can postpone the discussion of thermodynamics laws till the coffee break. Other questions?
Are the CMCs for these lipids known, and how well does your model reproduce them?
I trust the CMCs for these lipids are known. I wouldn't know them by heart. I would doubt that we're reproducing the CMC correctly, and it would be a very hard thing to measure, because I expect the CMCs to be somewhere in the 10 to the minus 10 or something, correct me, yeah, 10 to minus 10. That's very, yeah. I'm not so worried about the CMC, because the reason why I might want to get the CMC right is if I'm actually interested in the balance of lipids inside, lipids outside the bilayer. But there's no biological process that I know about, or at least care about, where the exchange of lipids in and out of the bilayer really matters. The only thing I want to make sure is that my bilayer doesn't fall apart, which it doesn't. and that if it like if it's about to fall apart, that there's the CMC is low enough for the thing to heal itself. We have done much simpler models of lipids, which is 3 beads per lipid, where we can clearly see why either CMC is way off, because it's way too high. But a lot of the physics comes out nicely, it's the physics you would care about. So I'm not worried about it. We haven't measured it. I don't think it's going to be particularly accurate, given that I've parameterized it starting from the bilayer state, and nothing in this parameterization uses, let's say, the dilute state.
Marcus. So I want to ask about trying to use this scheme and going towards some problems which really depend upon the electrostatic nature of the whole system, because that's a difficulty you have in the fact that the lipid bilayer actually, you know, like the dielectric constant varies greatly. Do you think you can use this as is, or even with future changes, to treat problems of that sort?
I think my view on that would require another talk, but let me try to give you the quick answer. There's probably a lot of aspects of bilayer physics which depend on charge where there's no way that I could treat them here. There are certain aspects where I don't need to drag things into the bilayer, where I'm just talking about binding of a protein to a bilayer, which I can sort of capture in by a short-range interaction potential. But clearly the fact that there's a dielectric boundary, a dielectric interface and stuff like this will make it very hard to capture. But precisely because it is so very hard to get that right, in a coarse grain model where a lot of the electrostatics and the dielectrostatics, if you like, doesn't happen automatically, I think that is true for every coarse grain model. Doing electrostatics right is really hard once you throw the water out. And for that reason, since I could put charges in there, that's not a principal problem, but I would be making a lot of mistakes. I'm also making mistakes now. And sort of I know what mistakes I'm making, what things I shouldn't probably be looking at. And since I'm making mistakes both ways, I chose to do it in a way where I don't have to bother with an expensive part of my component. Just because I could charges in there doesn't mean I have now captured electrostatics. I'm just being upfront about it. It's not in there. And I don't think there's an easy way to put it into the coarse grain model.
Marcus.
Yes.
I think these the results you have for the helix bundle protein are really quite impressive. And I was wondering if you could comment a little bit about how your peptide model works for beta structures and proteins that have significant beta content, like protein G. Is that significantly harder to get than the sort of more local interactions you get in the helix?
Betas are hard to get, because for any proteins of the same size, if you take it and make a helix and almost every hydrogen bond is satisfied, if you make a beta sheet, then half of them are not. So the only way to get completely satisfied beta sheets is if you just look at huge aggregates. One thing that we've done is we looked at small peptides and sort of things taken out of prion proteins and so on, but we know they make beta sheets, and they do. We haven't done huge beta sheets, but they do this. We have recently done another study where we looked at a particular situation where we get satisfied beta sheets, where we looked at a beta barrel at a particular location for some viral capsids have at their symmetry size beta barrels. These beta barrels have certain stabilization properties. If you change boundary conditions a little bit, they do happen or they do not happen, and that comes out as experimentally expected. Other than that, betas are indeed really hard to get because they're kind of finicky.
Yeah, I mean, I think the reason I ask is there's been, at least in things like the structure prediction community with coarse grain models, a lot of different ways of sort of fidgeting around with the potentials for the beta part.
Right. I mean,
and
there's work.
They're very sensitive to that.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of work on amyloids, for instance. And my impression by looking at the force fields is that they see all these beta structures, and the reason they see them, because the force fields are very heavily biased towards getting beta, and they would never see an alpha helix. We don't want to do that. We want the balance to be right, and the price to pay is that it's not quite easy to get a beta sheet. Part of the reason why we have this dipole term in there.
I'd like to ask about the lipid model. Do you ever get a tilted low temperature phase? I mean, they were all untilted in the pictures you showed.
I can't quite answer that because we haven't very carefully studied the gel phases on our system. This depends a little bit on the head group size versus the tail group size. So looking at DOPC versus DPPC might make, of course, a difference. Since I'm always kind of the fan of the fluid phases, I have never bothered into studying them.
I was just interested because DPPC, the low temperature phase, should be tilted, but for example, Martini gets it untilted.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why.
I could look at that. The DPC, if we do the tail swapping and create DPPC. We get a correct switch in the phase transition temperature by 30 degrees. That comes out well, and the area per lipid shrinks within 2% of what it should. So in that sense, it comes out very nicely. So if we now were to look at the tilt, it might turn out to be, I haven't done it yet. I mean, if you convince me that's like the most awesome thing to do, I might be persuaded. It is, okay, already two votes for.
Other questions?
I have a short question to the beginning. Did I get this right when you tried to get the dynamic mapping out, but you compared for coarse grain simulation to experiment?
Yes.
What about if you compare directly to the data you get from the microscopic simulation and use a time scaling from there and compare that to experiment?
I probably could do this. I just, as far as the dynamical properties of these systems are concerned, I still trust experiment more than the atomistic simulations.
That I didn't ask. I asked what comes out if you do it that way.
Well, basically, the only old question is I would have to look, what's the diffusion coefficient predicted by that particular lipid model? I don't know, but I mean, I could look it up and just do a different scaling, it would change my number.
Well, in the absence of water, it's going to be hard.
No, I mean, atomistically, what's the atomistic prediction for the diffusion coefficient, and then
there is none.
Well, you can run them a couple of hundred nanoseconds. That's long enough. Well, you get nearest neighbor within, let's say, 20, 30 nanoseconds, but 500 people done a microsecond.
So believe this is a homework for tomorrow.
You give me the number. So,
so submit the job to us tomorrow. Other questions? I have a philosophical question about the general approach. Mm-hmm. You're fine-tuning your potentials based on some hydrophobic interaction based on the data from mm-hmm. folding. Then you're expecting, when you put your protein inside the membrane, and there are a lot of new interactions there, and you're not fine-tuning those beyond just detailed amino acids.
Mm-hmm.
How do you expect the folded structure
inside
the bilayer?
Yeah.
Because there are a lot of new things there.
Yes.
That you need to keep fine tuning. Otherwise, I mean, this is not based on physics. It's based on the data.
Yes.
Information.
That's an excellent question. I should say we haven't, in that sense, fine tuned the peptide interaction, but we have matched it in some fancy way to a hydrophobicity scale. And clearly there's the one thing, if you take it out of your solvent and put it inside the hydrophobic environment, maybe you just have to flip your hydrophobicity scale over, do something about it. We were clearly planning on doing that. And then we realized the following thing. There's a little bit of beautiful magic going on, which is the following. On the transition from the implicit solvent into the implicit hydrophilic solvent to the explicit hydrophobic solvent, that inversion happens automatically. The reason is, if you think, for instance, two hydrophobic beads, they should attract in the bulk, but they should not attract in the bilayer because everything's hydrophobic. But if you now take these hydrophobic beads into an explicit bilayer representation where every other bead is also hydrophobic, they are in an environment where everyone is like them, and this interaction vanishes. Or if you take hydrophilic beads in the bulk, they shouldn't attract. You now put them in the bilayer, and they should, and they do, because now those are the only guys that don't have an attraction, so they're being pushed together. That comes out right. Anything beyond that would probably require me to do a complete repermatization of this thing, which would get basically the same thing, but with slight adjustments. I would probably be willing to do that, except there's much less data on that to do that.
Right. So you don't think you need to readjust your epsilon, because you had a whole bunch of epsilons you were fine tuning.
I could try to adjust it or even the scale.
You don't have data to do it.
I don't have enough data to do it, but we checked, for instance, you take a helix in the bilayer, which is stable because of all kinds of effects. You put it in there. Does it now have the right amount of stability? Does it fluctuate in the right amount as predicted by atomistic simulations of helices in bilayers? And that comes out well. So you look at the RMSD of a helix in this solvent, and then the RMSD of a helix in the bulk, and it goes exactly the right way. Based on that, I'm confident I'm not doing it totally wrong. If I want to do it better than that, I need better data to adjust.
And Mark, last question you had? No?
No good.
Anybody, last short question? Okay, great. Thank you very much. Perfect on time.